You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell. A failed summit in Hanoi between President Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. Is there any chance to get to denuclearization of North Korea? We ask an expert on North Korea from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. And that's tonight. Sun Yung Lee is professor in Korean and East Asian Studies and a specialist on North Korea at Tufts University, my alma mater, so we're particularly proud to have him on the show. He's also an associate in research at Korea Institute at Harvard. I haven't heard much about that, Harvard, whatever it is. But Professor Lee has provided advice to the U.S. government and is an outspoken proponent of several policies aimed at changing the North Korean regime towards a path of denuclearization and improvement of human rights while keeping the peace and stability in Northeast Asia. Welcome, Professor. Honor to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So we have this summit of two guys with really bad hair. Was it a failed summit, and was that better than a bad deal?
Well, as in a prize fight, when the contest ends in an unsatisfactory draw or a controversial decision, usually a sequel follows. So I expect Trump-Kim Summit 3 at some point, because both men want it. And does it really change the power dynamics, the interests of the two parties? I don't think so. I think Kim, probably for the first time in his life, was snubbed, and he was taken aback by that. I'm sure he's never been treated like that, where President Trump just said, okay, you know, see ya. I have things to do. Trump was to leave, you know, scheduled to leave Hanoi before Kim, but certainly that took the wind out of Kim's itinerary in Vietnam over the next 2 days, and I'm sure Kim felt, dumped, snubbed by it. So North Korea held a press conference late night that day and said strange things like, all we sought was sanctions relief from the UN Security Council resolutions passed after 2016 to improve the livelihood of the people, which is somewhat ironical. But that's like saying, you know, we just sought 99% of sanctions to be terminated, because before 2016, neither UN nor US sanctions had any bite. Mm-hmm. They were defensive and reactive, and they really did not target North Korea's access to the international financial services, banking services, and sectors like prohibition on North Korea's coal exports or textiles or steel or minerals. So that was disingenuous of the North Korean foreign minister to say, we just wanted a little bit of sanctions relief. And then his deputy, Madam Choi, who's been an American U.S. handler, manager for decades now, she's usually good, but she said something stupid as well. She said, this was an historically unprecedented offer that we gave to the U.S., so here was your best chance. That's not true, because all that North Korea offered on the table was selling the same pony thrice now, the Yongbyon nuclear reactor, which Kim Jong-un's father sold with success mm-hmm. in the 1990s and 2000s. And then in 2005, North Korea put down in ink in paragraph 1 of the September 19th, 2005 joint statement that the DPRK, that North Korea, quote, is committed to abandoning all nuclear weapons and existing nuclear weapons programs. What I'm trying to say is, you know, they have lied in the past repeatedly and reaped billions in benefits, and that was an unwitting admission that they've been lying all along.
You know, and also, apparently there's been testing back up ICBMs and still enriching uranium. And I read even 2 weeks before the summit. So first off, you were saying that Kim was sort of stood up there. So did President Trump actually do a smart thing by the way he walked out? And are they ever serious about really denuclearizing or even suspending testing for any real length of time?
Well, if you were to ask that question to any of the 8 other nuclear weapons states, mm-hmm. China, Russia, U.S., you know, the yep. U.K., France, India, Pakistan, Israel, I think very few listeners would even entertain that thought, that it's actually feasible through diplomacy, artful diplomacy, to compel the target nation to give it up. No other country has dangled before the international community the possibility of denuclearization. North Korea is the only country that has been able to bamboozle the world mm-hmm. For decades now by doing this. And, you know, because North Korea is so backward and weird, because it's such a strange amalgamation of medieval mores and buffoonish bellicosity, we tend to patronize North Korea. We tend to assume there's just a small backward nation, so for the right price, maybe they'll give it up. Well, one could say, and I would, that exactly for the same reasons, because they have nothing else and they have to contend with a far richer magnetic South Korea, they would never give it up under the current circumstances where they feel no real biting financial or diplomatic pressure.
Does that mean that President Trump has sort of conceded that they do not have to denuke first, speed doesn't matter? Is that a concession that falls right into the path that Kim would like?
I think President Trump made the mistake of impulsively agreeing to Kim Jong-un's proposition for a blind date for the first summit last year, and now he's been trapped into this never-ending process of negotiations, during which time Kim will buy more time and money in the form of lax or non-sanctions enforcement against his regime, with which to do what he really desires, which is to, you know, grow to further advance his nuclear capabilities. So time is not on our side, but President Trump was right to walk away from this trap, from this deal.
Let me ask you this. What is the strategic rationale for Kim out of any deal? Obviously, to Trump and to me, it would the economic growth side would be a brilliant thing that North Korea could bite onto. But is that what is his strategic rationale in your mind to do anything?
Well, if you look at the basic internal dynamic in the Korean Peninsula, you have two Korean states, North Korea and South Korea. The people of Korea have a long shared past, a sense of we versus they, Korea versus the outside world mentality. They were not divided geographically or politically for over 1,000 years until the principal victors of the Second World War, the U.S. and the USSR, temporarily divided the Korean Peninsula, really to facilitate the surrender of Japanese troops dispersed throughout the Korean Peninsula because Korea was Japan's colony. So that temporary division, which has held for over 7 decades, means that the two Korean states have been engaged in a contest, an existential contest for pan-Korean legitimacy, which is the more legitimate Korean state. If you rephrase that question and ask the DPRK, North Korea, why do you really have to exist? You know, what is your raison d'etre? What is the mission of the Kim regime? Mm-hmm. Then the answer becomes rather complicated because you have already a very successful, legitimate, free, affluent Korean state across the border. You know, why does there need to be another Korean state? So the sheer existence, the magnetic appeal of South Korea to the North Korean people, that is a long-term threat to the Kim regime. Well, how do you take care of that long-term existential threat as a despotic Korean state? You try to wipe it out. How do you achieve that? First, by becoming a credible threat to South Korea's biggest patron, biggest supporter, the United States, by becoming a credible nuclear threat to the U.S. mainland, and then through carrots and sticks, compel the U.S. to sign a peace agreement a la Vietnam in 1973, which will lead to the withdrawal of U.S. troops, downgrading of U.S. support for South Korea, after which North Korea will be better positioned to extort, bully, censor South Korea, and then you hope to move right in.
Just like North Vietnam did.
Exactly. That's the Vietnam model. So there's no, there's really endless irony in the administration preaching to North Korea, you too can be like Vietnam, follow the Vietnam model. Mm-hmm. You can remain a single-party communist dictatorship and grow richer like Vietnam. The Vietnam model has a specific meaning in North Korean political lexicon, and that is, you know, the Vietnam model of communist unification.
So does he realize that he's got to grow the economy there at all? Does he care about that? Does he care about his people?
Well, when North Korea suffered the famine more than 20 years ago, and this is a unique phenomenon because it is the North Korean famine is the only case of an industrialized, urbanized, literate society undergoing a famine. It shall forever remain the only case. I'm convinced of that. Always famines have stricken countries that are pre-industrial, agriculture-based, immiserated economies where adult illiteracy is quite high. North Korea does not fit that pattern. So when that famine happened, maybe upwards of 10% of the North Korean people died of starvation. Did North Korea really flinch? Did the regime allow even the delivery of international food aid to underprivileged people in rural provinces? No. So North Korea, the regime, shows little regard for human life. And as long as the elites in Pyongyang, in the showcase capital city, and the military and men with access to big guns are placated, I don't think the regime really needs to worry too much about growing the national economy. There is the separate palace economy, which feeds the elites, and then the rest of the population that has to fend for themselves.
You'll see the Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated over the Business Talk Radio Network. You can go to biztalkradio.com. Listen over the internet, access our podcast, and find the station closest to you. Coming up, Professor Lee's Vision for Peace. We're back with Sun Yoon Lee, professor in Korean and East Asian Studies, a specialist in North Korea at Tufts University. So let me ask you this, then. I'm thinking, if I'm holding a summit, the U.S. ultimate goal is denuking North Korea, and that's not going to happen from their perspective. And the ultimate goal for North Korea is to reunify and run the whole Korean Peninsula. China, the U.S., South Korea, Japan, nobody will ever allow that, right?
Not necessarily, because if you think about it,
oh, really?
You know, the United States abandoned South Vietnam after 58,000 American lives lost, tens of billions of U.S. dollars, you know, poured in. And in the end, you know, many, many decades later, that seems to be the pragmatic, the right choice even. So can the world live with a united despotic People's Republic of Korea where South Korea is no more and the Kim regime has full control over the entire Korean peninsula? It's not a very attractive proposition, but, you know, with time, from a pseudo-philosophical perspective, one can live with that. There are many risks, and we don't want to go there. But is the international community doing anything really to thwart that very unpromising future in the form of real meaningful sanctions enforcement against the palace economy of Pyongyang? Not really. The United States has never enforced sanctions against North Korea in a meaningful way, except for a brief one-year period in 2017. The Trump administration deserves credit for being the first U.S. administration to really try hard to enforce sanctions against North Korea. But even that effort, that short-lived effort, pales in comparison to previous administration sanctions enforcement against Iran, levying fines in the billions of dollars and hundreds of millions of U.S. dollars on sanctions violators, including major banks of the world.
So is Trump sort of delusional about this? Does personal diplomacy work? And is this just about getting a Nobel Peace Prize or something?
Well, I think President Trump is now waking up to the reality that denuclearization is not going to take place overnight, that he cannot just tame the funny-looking North Korean dictator. There's a long tendency on the part of every single U.S. administration, going back to the Harry Truman administration, of patronizing, looking down on, underestimating North Korea. And the reasons are, you know, fairly obvious. If there were such a thing as an international mockability index, Kim would be number one forever, you know. But it's a mistake because they are very, very crafty. They know how to do propaganda, as weird as they look and sound. They know how to do provocations and post-provocation peace ploys. So what Kim Jong-un has been doing for the first 6 years of his rule, acting weird, belligerent, never meeting with a single world leader, never traveling outside his country, that's exactly what his father did from 1994 to 2000 in the first 6 years of Kim Jong-un's rule. He did that, and then all of a sudden he showed up in Beijing, Kim II, that is, in May 2000. In June, he received the South Korean president. In July 2000, Putin visited him. In September, the Chinese president visited him. In October 2000, Kim Jong-il sent a special envoy to Bill Clinton, invited Clinton to visit. And Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State, was in Pyongyang just 10 days later, 12 days later. And Clinton actually was intent on going to North Korea, controversial as it was. But it never materialized due to the vote, Florida vote recount between, you know, Al Gore and George W. Bush. So history is repeating itself.
So let me ask you this, then. You've been talking very rational goals of North Korea. this guy's killed his half-brother, his uncle. Are you saying he's not crazy and he's not irrational?
No, no, he's not crazy. He looks crazy. And I think North Korea is very, very good at weaponizing their own weirdness, their own weird image. I think it's a major strategic asset that they've cultivated. So again, for the first 6 years of his rule, you know, meet with Dennis Rodman, but no world leader, act crazy, sound crazy, kill off, you know, your uncle, your half-brother. You know, to them, it's business, not really personal, because North Korea is a giant criminal syndicate. North Korea is the only country in the world that, as a matter of state policy, produces and sells drugs, counterfeits, you know, fake U.S. $100 bills, produces and sells famous U.S. brand cigarettes like Marlboro. So the way they operate is really reminiscent of the mob and, you know, killing your relatives, your rivals. That's business.
Wow. Let me ask, does Trump lack the history? I mean, I read, you know, that they lulled their nuke tests in 06, 09, and 13. So from a historical perspective, they're doing nothing different now. The second part of that question is, how does Kim define denuclearization versus our vision of it?
Well, we have this strange phrase, denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula,
yes.
Instead of North Korea. And that phrase made its international debut, if you will, in the September 19th, 2005 joint statement of the six-party talks, so-called six nations, including North Korea, U.S., Russia, China, Japan, and South Korea, that were engaged in denuclearization negotiations between 2003 and 2008. So why not say denuclearization of North Korea? There are no nukes in the South. The U.S. has settled for that strange formulation so as not to upset North Korea, I suppose. But now Kim has come out and said, spelled out what they mean by, what North Korea means by denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, mutual disarmament. That is, the U.S. Yeah. needs to leave. The U.S. needs to withdraw its nuclear extended deterrence to South Korea and to Japan, with full withdrawal of U.S. troops, no more U.S. weapons, strategic assets in the region. So, you know, it's important to be precise about definitions and even propaganda North Korean lexicon. And now the administration is using North Korean phraseology like, we have to end this war now. There has been 7 decades of hostility. These are all North Korean verbiage. End the war now, as if there's been active war over the past 7 decades. Yes, the Korean War ended not with a formal peace treaty and a ceasefire agreement, but there has been actual peace, as in no war, and that has implications because South Korea has grown very rich over the past 7 decades. North Korea went the other way, and that means South Korea is very much risk-averse, does not have the appetite to escalate tension with North Korea. And whenever North Korea threatens, the tendency is to placate North Korea, to give money to North Korea.
Okay, so there's a huge gap in even the definition of denuking. Should there be summits at the presidential level with that big of a gap?
I don't think so. I don't think there's all that much to gain because, again, I'm sure President Trump, in part, was motivated by the opportunity of making history and taming the funny-looking North Korean dictator. But it really doesn't work that way. People who have met Kim, the first, the second, and this one, all come away impressed that the North Korean leader is not crazy or stupid, that he's knowledgeable, he comes across as reasonable, even charming. Well, of course, many dictators of the world are very well informed and intelligent. They're not raving lunatics.
Yeah. So I almost get the sense that Kim out-negotiates the art of the deal guy, Trump.
He did, certainly, in the first summit in Singapore last June. But on this occasion, the fact that Trump just kind of dumped him and left him there, I think North Korea was really surprised by that.
So we're under a minute. But the fact is that isn't that highly predictable that it wasn't that it was going to fail, even if Trump had stayed and tried to, you know, gloss things over? There was no way it was going to be successful, true or not?
It's true. And yes, Trump did avert another disaster, but it doesn't change the equation.
You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Coming up, more on North Korea. And we're back with North Korean expert Professor Sung Yoon Lee of Tufts. And you used the term Trump unwittingly laid on the line heading into this, and you had it in the context of the future of South Korea, Japan's security, and a diminishing influence of the U.S. in the region. What do you exactly mean?
Well, if the United States deems South Korea expendable the way it did South Vietnam, which is a big if because we know South Korea is a major country, a major trading nation.
Yeah. We've got troops there.
Troops there, yes. But if the U.S. decides that in order to protect Americans at home on the mainland, which is, of course, the first priority obligation of any U.S. government, in order to avert North Korea's nuclear attack on U.S. soil, that it is the right move to withdraw troops and to let the Korean people figure it out among themselves. That is, you know, if the U.S. were ever to abandon South Korea, right, as it did in 1949 and also in 1905, then there will be a power vacuum, probably which will work as an invitation to aggression by North Korea. North Korea will probably liberate the South, that is, complete its communist revolution by taking over, because I really believe, wow, South Korea just doesn't have the stomach to fight. It's there's been no war in the Korean Peninsula for 7 decades now, and it's almost inconceivable to the South Korean people that all the wealth that's visible could be lost. So rather than go to war against North Korea, I think a political settlement will be...
So it might end up like Hong Kong or South Vietnam, where the economy would be allowed to thrive?
Yeah, I think Kim Jong-un could actually win, liberate the South without even firing a single shot.
Wow.
And this has been North Korea's game plan. It's all, you know, stipulated in North Korean documents. That is, first, sue for a peace treaty with the U.S., get, wow, the U.S. out, pesky Americans out of there, and then establish a joint inter-Korean parliament, and then have elections a few years later. And when you think about it, South Korea is bigger, twice the size of the North in terms of population. There are 25 million in the North, 51 million in the South. But in South Korea, the presidential candidate who wins eventually never garners more than 50% of the vote, with one exception. Usually it's about 37, you know, 30-something. So that means there will be South Korean candidates that will vie with the North Korean candidate. Fully 25 million in the North will vote for Kim Jong-un. There are many pro-North Korean South Koreans too. South Koreans who are very favorably disposed toward the North, living in South Korea. So,
really,
from a rational perspective, you know, Kim could win a nationwide pan-peninsular election.
This just stuns me.
Stunning. It's inconceivable almost, but that's the game plan.
Should we be engaging North Korea as we're trying to, or pushing for regime change, or can you do both?
I think at the very least, the U.S. can and should negotiate from a position of strength. Going back to the Obama administration in its effort to get Iran back to the negotiating table, it took 3 years of real tough sanctions enforcement trying to isolate Iran to make it feel the economic pinch just to get it back to the negotiating table. The U.S. fined the biggest bank in France for repeated violations of U.S. sanctions laws on Iran and Sudan and Cuba as well, $9 billion. $9 billion with a B. The U.S. fined HSBC $2 billion, a German bank, yeah, $1.45 billion. That's how you compel your target to behave, not by summit pageantry.
Should we be pushing for human rights improvement?
Absolutely, because unless North Korea becomes a bit more transparent and less despotic, there's really no way to trust them. North Korea lies about everything. North Korea still claims that the U.S. started the Korean War of 1950, when everyone knows that it was a well-thought-out, prepared, large-scale invasion by the North. So human rights is certainly not irrelevant to nuclear diplomacy. The U.S. should do a lot more in terms of funding radio stations and other human rights organizations in their efforts to disseminate information, basic information, into North Korea, and the funds available for Voice of America, Radio Free Asia, and so on, are really paltry. They're dreadfully small.
In fact, looking at your vision for peace, you call for dual strategy of sanctions and an information warfare campaign.
Yes, because, again, it's unlikely that the people of North Korea will rise up and challenge the regime. North Korea is unique in that there are no, you know, labor unions, there are no dissidents, there are no opposition parties, of course. There has been no meaningful demonstration in North Korea that we know of. So the regime's totalitarian grip over the population is the most perfected. It's the best. It's the most, you know, deplorable,
wow,
but the most advanced ever in history. So while it's unlikely that the people will rise up in unison against the Kim regime, I think we, the civilized portions of the world, should do a lot more to try to raise awareness, to try to disseminate more information into North Korea so that the people at least are more motivated to explore other opportunities like escaping their repressive nation.
So Trump moving from Rocket Man and Fire and Fury to saying I love him or we love each other is probably not a smart thing to try and legitimize this guy?
It's a dangerous thing because Kim has, you know, effected a beautiful image makeover. He's gone from crazy Rocket Man to a legitimate, reasonable, reform-minded leader now. But more importantly, by doing so, you know, Kim is able to buy more time to grow his lethal capabilities. So Fire and Fury was unnecessary, but you see how Kim has turned the table around. That is, President Trump believes that it was his tough rhetoric and maximum pressure, so-called, that compelled Kim to change his tune from one of belligerence to, you know, outgoing.
And you don't buy that at all?
No, because when you look at the record, you know, Fire and Fury, that threat was made on August 8th, 2017.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
3 weeks later, Kim fired a missile over Japan on the 29th, which is August 29th, which is known as National Humiliation Day in the Korean Peninsula, because it was on that date in 1910 that Japan colonized Korea. And then Kim explained that, you know, to everyone kindly. This was a message to Japan. And then 5 days later, on September 3rd, 2017, Kim conducted the nation's most powerful nuclear test. Does that strike you as the typical behavior of a frightened man? I don't think so. And then, you know, Trump derided, called Kim Rocket Man on a suicide mission, total destruction at the UN General Assembly in mid-September. And a couple of months later, Kim fired off the most powerful ICBM for his nation to date. So I think, you know, Kim's peace offensive starting in early 2018 was preordained. It was all planned.
Wow. Should the U.S. ever pull its troops out of South Korea then, forgetting that there may be just political pressure to bring them home, but should we keep them there?
Well, I mean, you know, it's up to the United States government and the South Korean government. If the South Koreans say, Yankee, go home, and they've been chanting, some segments of the South Korean population have been saying that for decades. But will that work in the best interest of the United States? I don't think so, because then you have a North Korea-dominated Korean peninsula. Japan will freak out. Japan's greatest security fear is to be surrounded by hostile or quasi-hostile states armed with nukes. So that's a grim prospect for Japan. Japan will be incentivized to defend itself and go nuclear out of fear of abandonment by the U.S. as well. So you might have nuclear proliferation in Northeast Asia, which is not a good thing. You might have a more belligerent, a more provocative, daring North Korea trying to extort the United States. So that's not a good thing. And I think the possibility of war, paradoxically, increases with a peace agreement under the current situation. Unless the North Korean regime moderates itself and becomes a more normal, less despotic regime, I think withdrawing U.S. troops from South Korea is really inviting a disaster.
What should the role be of China? What's China's strategic perspective, and how would we want them to come in and help?
Well, you know, China has always had great influence, political, economic influence over the Korean Peninsula, except for the period, so-called, the century of national humiliation, as China says, between the mid-19th century to the founding of the People's Republic in 1949. Today, China enjoys great economic really overwhelming economic and political influence over both North Korea and South Korea, which means South China is perfectly fine with how things are, with a North Korea that occasionally makes China look bad, but, you know, is very useful to China in China's long-term strategic contest with the U.S. South Korea is beholden to China. South Korea doesn't say anything, even when China unilaterally sanctions South Korea for deploying a missile, anti-missile defense system. So China is pretty happy and is going along with the flow. That is, yes, occasionally condemn North Korea after a nuclear test, but behind the scenes increase aid to North Korea. China and North Korea are formal treaty allies.
You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Coming up, more on North Korea. Final segment, North Korean expert Sun Yoon Lee. One thing, it seems like we have Kim taking a very long-term, even strategic vision, and the United States tends to be very short-term oriented, and Trump seems to even be almost impulsively short-term oriented. That's working in their favor, right?
Absolutely. You know, and this tendency to patronize, underestimate North Korea goes back to the early days of the bilateral relationship. In the wake of North Korea's invasion of the South, starting the Korean War in 1950, a senior person in the State Department said that the relationship between Stalin and Kim, the original great leader, the grandfather of the current leader, the relationship between Stalin and Kim Il-sung is exactly the same as that between Walt Disney and Donald Duck, meaning, you know, Kim is a puppet, Stalin's puppet. He's merely following orders that the war was a test of U.S. resolve by Stalin. It was no such thing. It was Kim Il-sung's war. Stalin and Mao were reluctant supporters of Kim, and they were quite concerned about U.S. intervention, the bigger communist patrons, that is. So, you know, this tendency to think that the weird-looking North Korean dictator doesn't have a strategic mind of his own and is merely following orders from Moscow or Beijing, it's a dangerous misassessment. And I think that attitude pervades a lot of the Trump administration's approach to North Korea through summit diplomacy, the privilege of shaking hands with the U.S. president, through, you know, history-making snapshots, photo opportunity. North Korea will be awakened to a new reality, have a moment of epiphany, and give up its nukes and concentrate on economic development. I think that's a pipe dream.
Wow. Is there any role, briefly or quickly, for the UN?
Most of these agencies and other NGOs merely follow North Korea's initiatives. North Korea is the only aid recipient country in the world that does not abide by international standards for humanitarian aid distribution and monitoring. North Korea doesn't allow it. I think, you know, UN agencies should use their considerable material and moral leverage to make some basic demands, you know, to call on the regime not to crack down on markets, you know, not to insist that agencies use only tainted designated bank, North Korea's foreign trade bank, not to confiscate food from certain regions, the breadbasket of North Korea. So there's a lot more that the UN should do, but the UN is simply silent when it comes to North Korea's strange approach to statecraft.
Okay, so you've called for a long view of unwavering pressure, sanctions, and I think you've called for, and would this be critical to freeze Kim's assets, his circle around him amongst European, U.S., and Chinese banks, and really try to block money laundering, et cetera? Has Kim moved a lot of money out of the country and stuff?
Well, we know Kim has a slush fund, funds here and there in China and European banks. We also know that the regime depends on illicit activities, illegal activities like counterfeiting and selling drugs and so on. So the regime is vulnerable. It has a very high pain threshold because it doesn't care about the lives of its own people. Mm-hmm. But the regime is vulnerable when it comes to financial sanctions.
Could we bring them to their knees that way?
I'm not so sure, but at the very least, we could certainly enhance our leverage, negotiating position by sanctioning North Korea over time. You know, sanctions take time to bear effect. There's no magic bullet in sanctions, and you need to really have sustained sanctions enforcement over several years, and we've never been there.
All right, as we finish up, I'd like you to talk about what do you think is most likely to happen, then we'll talk best and worst.
Well, Kim is very good at dangling the carrot of denuclearization, the possibility of denuking. So in the meantime, I believe Kim has more to gain by moderating his behavior. So what will he do? Medium-scale provocations like launching a satellite, which probably will not even engender a UN backlash, a UN Security Council resolution, and maybe on the propaganda front, take out some expensive ads in the New York Times or the Times of London. They used to do this in the old days, seriously, paying for, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to make the point that we want peace, we want economic reform, and it's the United States that's petulant and preventing us from achieving these important national goals. And that kind of propaganda warfare will paint North Korea in a more favorable light and the Trump administration in a less favorable light. And in the meantime, you know, buy time to further advance his nuclear capabilities. That's the North Korean game plan, as far as I can tell.
All right. Give us the best case. And so it sounds like you don't see them ever denuking.
No, because it would be tantamount to treason for them to give away the one panacea, as they see it, that could one day perhaps overturn this inequality between North Korea and South Korea.
And protects them. It protects them fundamentally, right? That's giving up the major leverage they have in the world.
It does that too, but I think we make too big a deal of that.
Okay.
You know, North Korea is not paranoid. North Korea was able to deter the mighty U.S. with conventional weapons alone. You know, North Korea has killed dozens of U.S. soldiers over the past decades, and at no time has the U.S. retaliated with force out of fear of escalation. So, you know, North Korea has been thoroughly capable of deterring the U.S. even before going nuclear in 2006. Nuclear weapons are a powerful deterrent, but they also give you offensive capabilities, not literally merely, but, you know, in terms of political, economic leverage. So with nukes, North Korea is able to censor South Korea, to extort South Korea, and South Korea pays up.
Worst case scenario in your mind?
Worst case is North Korea becomes a direct, credible nuclear threat to the West Coast or even to Washington, D.C., and compels the U.S. to make a decision. Do I risk, do I put the lives of hundreds of thousands of Americans on the line in order to fulfill my treaty obligation to defend a key ally in South Korea? And at that point, I don't think any U.S. leader, any administration will settle for the former. The U.S. will abandon South Korea. Then you have North Korea marching right in and taking over, and a very different Korean Peninsula and a very different Northeast Asia, which is not favorable to U.S. interests.
Wow. Okay, we get down to the last under a minute. Are you optimistic that something will status quo or will maintain, or are you optimistic at all, or are you see the long view?
Well, the South Korean government right now is also a problem because it's so keen on placating pleasing North Korea. It wants to resume the kinds of generous, unconditional aid, giving North Korea almost $1 billion as it used to for a decade between 1998 and 2008. So under the current dynamics, I'm not very optimistic. I think Kim Jong-un is sitting pretty right now in Pyongyang, and you know he's calling the shots. As hard as it is to believe that it's the weird-looking North Korea calling the shots, I see it that way.
Wow. Thanks to Professor Sun Yung Lee from Tufts. Thanks to our national audience for listening. We'll see everybody again next week on another edition of Business Talk with Jim Campbell.